This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In Shalini Kantaya's new documentary film, a young MIT researcher tells the story about a piece of facial recognition software she was working on. Her name is Joy Bulamini, and she was thinking about becoming a robotic engineer. And she had invented this device called an Aspire Mirror, where you could superimpose the faces of people who inspire you over your own face. Now, if you have one of the new iPhones, you know that facial recognition software is here. It's being used by all kinds of tech companies and government agencies all around the world. Joy is black. And the thing about the technology she noticed is that as she tried to use it and work with it, it didn't recognize her face. Only when she put on a white mask did it register something.
I started looking at the data sets themselves, and what I've discovered is many of these data sets contain majority men and majority lighter-skinned individuals, so the systems weren't as familiar with faces like mine. And so that's when I started looking into issues of bias that can creep into technology.
Joy Bulamini is just one story in Shalini Kantaya's documentary. It's called Coded Bias. We're going to be screening it this month as part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We'll give you more details about that just a little later in the program. Kantaya joined us on the show earlier this year when her film premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. When we spoke with her, she told us about this meeting she had with a group of computer scientists. And she asked them this question, whether or not artificial intelligence has a point of view.
When I make films, I immerse myself in the subject matter. And before starting Coded Bias, I literally knew nothing about artificial intelligence. And so the Simons Foundation actually organized a group of artificial intelligence researchers for me to have lunch with. And so sitting with them, I sort of began to ask them a bunch of questions. And I think what's interesting, when you're coming to something absolutely fresh and you don't know anything about the subject matter, you ask questions that sometimes might feel naive. So asking...
Yeah. The basics.
Yeah, just asking, you know, an artificial intelligence researcher, you know, do machines have a POV? Do they have a character? Would you say that machines have something that might be racial characteristics or gender characteristics? Like, do they have a perspective? Does AI have a perspective? And it was really interesting to hear them, each of them, sort of answer that question differently.
And then that made you think what? Because this seems to be the thing that, I don't know if it was the moment that got you thinking about all of this, but it certainly was maybe a catalyst for you in some way?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we live in a world where we've come to trust machines so implicitly. If there's, say, a problem with your ticket and you say it, tell me something, and the computer tells me something, I'm going to absolutely believe the computer.
Right.
And yet we take that for granted and have never questioned it. And in the making of this film, I began to question this very notion of machine neutrality.
There's this theme in the film that comes up from time to time, and it's a point that you make that science fiction is not real science. Talk a little bit about your interest in science fiction first, because one of the things you've mentioned is that you have this passion, which is, I think, as you've described it, bordering on fanaticism for science fiction movie.
That's absolutely right. I am a very self-proclaimed sci-fi fanatic. I love imagining the future, and I love the way science fiction films have invited me to reimagine the future. And I think sometimes through science fiction and through it, through science fiction, you can sort of get this reflection of reality. And so very much, I think, like much of the public, I feel like I my imagination about artificial intelligence very much developed through science fiction, through movies like The Terminator and Metropolis and, oh God, the list goes on and on.
Blade Runner.
Blade Runner. The cyberpunk movies of the 90s. The list goes on and on. And so I feel like that is what first sort of captured my imagination about these technologies. And then when I started to look at like sort of TED Talks, I'm a TED fellow, and so I research a lot of technology, and I'm interested in the way technology sort of disrupts and changes society. And what I learned was that AI, you know, in the now, is so different than the world that we live in. Mm-hmm. While we're still imagining AI to be sort of talking robots, you know, AI is like, you know, in the information systems that we use in our cell phone. It's in the technologies that are deciding what we watch and what we see and in so many invisible systems. And so I felt like there was this massive gap between how we imagined artificial intelligence and the AI of the now that's making decisions about us. Right now.
When did you come across Joy Boulamini?
Well, I'm a TED fellow, and I watched her TED talk, which I thought was incredibly moving. And Joy had this incredible, first of all, a young woman with this incredibly unique perspective, and who's incredibly, she's a researcher at the MIT Media Lab, which is this culmination of technology and the arts.
Yeah. Young African-American woman. Tell us a little bit about her. She mentions in the film, because we hear some of her story.
Yes.
Wants to go to MIT since she was, what, 9?
Yes. Ghanaian-Canadian, grew up in the South, wanted to go to MIT since she was 9. Her father is a scientist. Her mother is an artist. And so she goes to MIT and wants to make cool art projects. Yeah. So she just wants to make sort of like an art project that projects things on your face, sort of like an Instagram filter, right? And
seems like a cool novel idea.
Yeah, seems like a cool novel idea for an art project that has no social use whatsoever.
Right.
And then, you know, lo and behold, she is just trying to get the computer to see her face, and it won't detect her face. And, you know, on a whim, she's got this white mask in her office from Halloween, basically, and puts it on, and the computer sees the white mask more than it sees her dark face.
Yeah.
And so through that sort of revelation, and then she starts, you know, sort of testing it and saying, was it just me? Was it just my face? Oh, no, it doesn't work on the whole cast of the Black Panther. Oh, it doesn't work on. And so then she starts to test really methodically using scientific method and data sets, and finds out that most of the commercially available facial recognition technology that we're using today doesn't work on dark faces or women with as much accuracy as white faces.
Yeah.
And that sort of sets her down this rabbit hole. And then, you know, this, what is so extraordinary about Joy is that it just doesn't stay in the land of research for her.
Yeah.
Then she begins to sort of meet Kathy O'Neill, an amazing mathematician who wrote a book called Weapons of Math Destruction, and learns about sort of how bias and algorithms are impacting all kinds of decision making, from healthcare to hiring to who gets a college education. And in ways sometimes we're not even aware of. Sometimes there's an AI decision making in the loop, and we don't even know why we've been denied something. For instance, I was at a TED conference, and I was talking to the superintendent of schools, and he did an enormous amount of research to figure out that there was an AI tool that was grading the essay portion of a standardized test.
Wow, the essay part.
The essay part. And, you know, from making this film, I learned that, you know, computers are doing this through mathematics. They don't speak English, right?
Yep.
And so I'm thinking, you know, an immigrant kid like me who grew up in a home where my parents' first language wasn't English and went to college with a big gap of vocabulary, in English vocabulary, I wouldn't have maybe made the grade of an AI system. And I would have maybe never known why I have been denied that application or never made it to the next round. And so these are all the invisible ways in which these AI systems are becoming gatekeepers.
It's interesting, too, that in Joy's experience, in Kathy's experience, and others, at first they thought, as Joy puts it, they could separate the social from the technical. Mm-hmm. But they both have this insight that they're put together, that technology is not detached from reality. I mean, it seems like that's an important way that they started to think, that no, this is technology absolutely has a profound effect in real terms.
Absolutely. And I think that I don't want to underplay that the data scientists and mathematicians in my film mostly have some kind of marginalized identity. Hmm. They're women or they're people of color. That sort of, they both have the, they're all technically astute, many of them PhDs in their field, but at the same time maybe had the experience of not belonging or being an outsider or being not who a system was optimized for. Mm-hmm. And so begin to think about what could this happen for the most vulnerable. And so it's these sort of outsiders and rebels, women and people of color and queer people in the tech industry, that end up being the leaders for the ethical practices in AI.
One of the ideas in the film is how machines themselves are, of course, this seems obvious, not biased, but they're just reflecting back our own biases. Mm-hmm. What does Joy mean when she says data is destiny?
Well, I can't speak for her, but I will tell you how I interpret her words and why it was so important for me to underscore that point in the film, that data is destiny. I'm going to use a sci-fi reference.
Okay, great.
I was very influenced by a film called Gattaca by Andrew Nichols.
Yeah.
In which it's a deterministic world that is sort of determined by your genetic data. And so at birth, you are assigned a likelihood, chance of succeeding. And through that, you're sort of tracked on a field based on that early determination of who you were by a computer system. And because of that, it presents the, you know, opportunities to you because of your past data. And so it becomes this deterministic model of prediction, a self-fulfilling prophecy. So for those of us who were the first in our families to go to college, or the first in our families to do something, or none of the data in the past defines who we're going to be in the future, it's just the opposite of what I believe in.
Yeah.
I believe in human potential to outrun their circumstances.
Yeah.
And so I believe that this like Meredith Broussard says in the film, if we rely on AI systems who are using data from the past, we're not going to have social progress. And that is my fear about AI systems.
That was the most frightening thing I think expressed in the film to me, is she talked about the fact that if you do, that progress will stop. Let me play this moment from Joy, because she mentions how embedded in this amazing new technology is these dated concepts from the past.
When you think of AI, it's forward-looking. But AI is based on data, and data is a reflection of our history. So the past dwells within our algorithms. This data is showing us the inequalities that have been here. I started to think this kind of technology is highly susceptible to bias. And so it went beyond, oh, can I get my Aspire mirror to work, to what does it mean to be in a society where artificial intelligence is increasingly governing the liberties we might have? And what does it mean if people are discriminated against?
You mentioned Meredith Broussard. She's a data journalism professor at NYU.
Mm-hmm.
And she says in the film that, you know, a lot of our ideas about AI are kind of imaginary. But what we actually have in real life is what she calls narrow AI, and that it's just math. And that this is an important theme in the film, that are ideas about artificial intelligence, about what, in fact, intelligence actually is, comes from just a few people. And I wanted to play this moment for Meredith mm-hmm. Broussard in the film because it's kind of an historical concept that I hadn't realized, that the ideas that were about AI, that we're thinking about now, this technology, these algorithms, comes from such a small well. Mm-hmm. Here's another moment from the film.
We've imbued computers with all of this magical thinking. AI started with a meeting at the Dartmouth Math Department in 1956. And there were only maybe 100 people in the whole world working on artificial intelligence in that generation. The people who were at the Dartmouth Math Department in 1956 got to decide what the field was. One faction decided that intelligence could be demonstrated by ability to play games, and specifically the ability to play chess.
In the final hour-long chess match between man and machine, Kasparov was defeated by IBM's Deep Blue supercomputer.
Intelligence was defined as the ability to win at these games.
Chess world champion Garry Kasparov walked away from the match, never looking back at the computer that just beat him.
Now, of course, intelligence is so much more than that. And there are lots of different kinds of intelligence. Our ideas about technology and society that we think are normal are actually ideas that come from a very small and homogeneous group of people.
What are the implications of that? That what we've come to define as technology and our ideas of intelligence come from just one perspective?
I think it has massive implications. I myself did not realize when I sort of set out to make this film what a small elite group of people sort of, I mean, and I learned that mathematicians have like genealogies and all kinds of things in ways in which it's sort of maintain its sort of elitism. But most of the ideas that we have about technology came from a really small elite group of people, and that influence the entire world. And I think Meredith gives us some perspective that that small elite group of people then gave birth to many of the big tech gurus that we have today.
No people of color, not really any women in those days. So the perspective was really defined in that way.
No, and I don't think our tech has ever recovered from that, quite frankly. I mean, many of those, I mean, we talk about MIT and the kinds of institutions that were backing it at the time that Meredith talks about it. She said, at the time of the Dartmouth Math Conference, there was like 100 institutions doing this stuff, 50 people in the world doing this stuff. And you know, many of the founders of Google, the founders of Facebook, the founders of Amazon were very much influenced by the same school of thought. And so now we have a very small elite group of people who have unprecedented power. Some might say power that might be unhealthy in the context of a democracy. And it's just not optimized for all of us.
Yeah.
And you have an industry like AI that's 14% women. And it's being deployed on all of us. And you can imagine what that means in terms of the shift of power and who is vulnerable. Look, we can't even get accountability on our Lyft and our Uber rides, right? You can't even get a person in the loop for that stuff. As we get more and more disconnected, as humans slip more and more out of this loop, I feel like there's a real danger in the way power is shifting. And you don't have to understand a neural network to understand how power is shifting because of big tech and the unprecedented power they have on our lives when it comes to the information we see and the types of choices we have in our lives. And it's up to we, the people, to sort of temper this power, both in demanding inclusiveness, right? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things I think I came across in the film is that, you know, we think of inclusiveness as something that's like good for the pictures, right?
It looks good.
It looks good. Yeah. It, you know, we'll put the sprinkles on top, right?
Yeah.
But what has become so apparent in the making of this film is that inclusion is that we are all biased, that we are all limited, that we are all flawed, and that is the beauty of being human. And we deeply need each other to see each other's perspectives, to understand our own biases, and to see into our blind spots. Mm. And that is what makes us human. And inclusion is not a side note. Inclusion is actually what makes us more competitive. It makes us more innovative in the technologies of the future. And if we're designing in a world that is global, we need our tech industries to represent a world that is global.
Shalini Kantaya, she's the director of the film Coded Bias, which premiered at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It's the latest film in our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Next Wednesday night, we're going to be hosting a live online screening of the film, followed by a live Q&A. Shalini will join us. For details about that, go to our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Station Insider is KUER's weekly email digest. We'll bring you the most important news stories of the week, information about online events and services during the coronavirus situation, and of course, sneak peeks at what's happening at the station. Check out our other regular dispatches too, including the Radio West newsletter. To sign up for these weekly updates, just go to KUER.org/newsletters.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the film Coded Bias. It's about facial recognition technology and the myriad algorithms built into our digital culture. This is about how this artificial intelligence is already making decisions about who gets hired or who gets arrested or who gets healthcare or who gets audited, and how these algorithms are also embedded with features that discriminate based on race or on gender. We spoke with the filmmaker Shalini Kantaya earlier this year when her film premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. We're going to be screening it next week. It's part of our series on documentary films. It's our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We'll give you more details about that a little bit later in the program.
I want to talk a little bit more about Kathy O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
Let me play another moment from the film. This is where Kathy is explaining what it is that I think worries her most about algorithms mm-hmm. and machine learning in the future. And she mm-hmm. strikes on a crucial point made in the film that it's about power.
Mm-hmm. Machine learning, it's a scoring system that scores the probability of what you're about to do. Are you going to pay back this loan? Are you going to get fired from this job? What worries me the most about AI or whatever you want to call it, algorithms, is power. Because it's really all about who owns the code. The people who own the code then deploy it on other people. And there is no symmetry there. There's no way for people who didn't get credit card offers to say, ooh, I'm going to use my AI against the credit card company. That's like a totally asymmetrical power situation. People are suffering algorithmic harm. They're not being told what's happening to them. And there is no appeal system. There's no accountability. Why do we fall for this?
She talks about how we have this blind faith in algorithms,
mm-hmm.
That there's somehow an objective truth. What does she worry about that way? That if we think about it as this objective thing, that we'll stop being careful? I mean, what is she really concerned about?
What Kathy made me realize, and you know, I only get half of what all these women are talking about. They're PhDs.
But I'm so glad you said that because I'm like, man, I can't. How should you keep up with them?
Oh my God, I couldn't go to parties in it for a year because I was so scared someone was going to ask me about the film I was making. But Kathy is so brilliant and does such a great job at this. But your question was about...
The blind faith. She's worried that we're having blind faith in an algorithm that we somehow see as this objective truth.
Exactly. And what Kathy made me realize is that algorithms are opinions embedded into code. And there is a perspective there. Because from my understanding is that to have an algorithm, you have to have a definition of success, what you're defining for a success, and you have to have data, past data. And so who is your system being optimized for? And these, at every process, these decisions are not being made by ethicists, they're not being made by society, they're being made by mathematicians. And so I think Kathy was sort of uniquely situated to tell that story. And anyway, she's a fantastic
Well, you tell her story in the film too. She talks about, and it's interesting, maybe we could say a little bit about it. She's 14, goes to math camp, learns to do a Rubik's Cube, grew up, as she said, in the film, with this perspective as an outsider, went to work for a hedge fund. Like, she went to make money, drank the Kool-Aid, she said, for a while, and then she started to see things. What's her transformation like that you explore in the film?
Yeah, I mean, you know what was so beautiful about Kathy is Kathy loves math. She loves math, and her brain is such a beautiful place. And so I think that Kathy was someone who really saw math as something that could be true and loved that idea and loved the idea that there was something beautiful and true and in math. And she's got this incredible passion for mathematics. And yet what she sees is that...
On Wall Street,
is that people lied, that these algorithms were targeted, and people were optimized to fail.
Yeah.
And what she says is, I thought this was a mathematical problem. I thought we didn't have enough data, enough statistics. I thought there was something wrong with the math. Mm. And then she says, no, I realized we didn't care about the math. We were just trying to make some money. And what she says is, this isn't a mathematical problem. This is a political problem.
Yeah.
And that is the discovery she makes, is that this isn't about math. This is about power. And what she says continually throughout the film is to not believe them when they say, ooh, magic, trust us, it's math. And to constantly question.
Let's talk about what's going on in Britain, which I have to say was stunning. Mm. You profile the work of a group called Big Brother Watch, in particular the director Silky Carlo.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about this. I have to say this surprised me, that we see a few shots on the streets in, I guess it's London, where police have these, basically they're experimenting with facial recognition software. And they're not just experimenting with it, they're detaining people because of all of this. Mm-hmm. Talk about this part.
Okay, so I first have to say that the reason I could get the footage, the rare footage that I got in the UK, was because they have some laws and they have more transparency. Mm-hmm. So I had to go to the UK because they do have the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regimen, that protects them, that gives them some access to even get this information for my film.
So it's happening in other places.
It could be, what is happening in the UK could be very much happening in the US, and I would never have access to that data. So I just want to put that out there.
Wow.
And so in the UK, because they have some notion of transparency, they were testing facial recognition, police use of facial recognition. And what you see happening both in the U.S. and in the U.K. and in democracies around the world is that police departments are picking up this tool without anyone in an elected office giving the go-ahead, essentially picking up a new tool and saying, this is something we can use. And so in the U.K., we tracked the police testing of real-time facial recognition on the street. So basically, they have a police database. We don't know who's on these databases or how you got on them, a secret watch list, and you are basically walking by and a computer is taking your biometric data and scanning you against a watch list. And based on that watch list, they can pull you over.
The guys up there informed me that they got facial recognition. I don't want my face recognised. Yeah, I was walking past, I covered my face. As soon as I covered my face like this...
You're allowed to do that.
He grabbed, no, I can't.
Yeah, and then he's just got a fine for it. This is crazy. A guy came out of the station, saw the placards, was like, yeah, I agree with you, walked past here with his jacket up. The police then followed him, said, give us your ID, doing an identity check. It's like, what? This is England. This isn't a communist state. I'll have to show my face.
I'm going to go and talk to these officers, all right? Do you want to come with me or not?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Now, I live in New York, where Bloomberg just apologized for stop and frisk.
Right.
Now, we know from Joy's research that these systems don't work as well on people of color and on women, and yet are being deployed by the police. And so you see very quickly the communities that are most likely to suffer the harms of this.
This film also explores how computers are... I have to say this was really helpful for me, how the programs, computers are programmed. So in one way, it's like a recipe. You know, you tell a computer what to do, what we want. Mm-hmm. But the other way, which is the way that's come to be used more and more now because we have all of this data, is that you just give the computer this data and let it digest it, let it classify it. And this was the interesting part about that. And this is where the Turkish sociologist Zeynep Tufekci comes in. Mm-hmm. She says, we don't really know how that works. I think she describes it as a black box. Would you talk about this part of the story?
It's exactly a black box. So basically, you're optimizing, you're giving that computer a definition of success, and you're giving it lots of data, and you're letting it digest that data. And the programmer themselves don't really understand how they arrived at this outcome. Mm. Now, Kathy will tell you that the roots of this algorithmic sort of trading came on Wall Street, right? So you getting an edge of just a little bit, right? If you're a little bit better than random on Wall Street, you're doing really well. But if you're a little bit better on random on deciding whether a teacher is a good teacher and should get to keep their job, then that's a whole different thing. And so one of the scary parts of this algorithmic automated decision making is that we don't know how the computer is arriving at this conclusion. And if the computer has made a mistake, it's very hard to go back and say how the mistake was made. And it's even more difficult to say, I can hold someone, a person, accountable for that decision. And that is why I think this is so dangerous for democracy.
Yeah, they've put these algorithms, they've gotten them started. And they're working, but they don't know how they work. They don't know the result. I mean, it seems like not enough is known exactly what is happening, but something is happening. There's no sense of control over it, it seems like, once now you've got it started.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a wonder, but I don't know what justice is going to look like in this framework.
Shalini Kantaya, her film was called Coded Bias. It premiered at the Sundance Film Festival this year. You can see it next Wednesday as part of our free online screening. This is our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Kantaya will join us for a live Q&A after the screening. And we have all of the details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER connects you to your community and brings you the facts about what's happening across our state. As part of our service-driven mission, we value your input. What issues should our reporters be covering where you live? Whose stories should we be telling? Do you have a question about a program or a story you heard on the station? By answering a few short questions, you can help us improve our statewide service. Consider leaving your feedback at KUER.org/feedback.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the filmmaker Shalini Kantaya. We're talking about her new documentary film. It's called Coded Bias. We're going to be screening it next week, next Wednesday night, as part of our documentary series. It's our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We'll give you details about the screening a little bit later in the program.
So the futurist Amy Webb is also in the documentary, and she writes about the big companies that are using this technology. And it's interesting, there are these two tracks that she talks about. One is the way technology is playing out in China. And it's interesting there, they're using it to maintain social order. Facial technology to do that, mm-hmm. You have what they call a social credit mm-hmm. score. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that and talk about the sort of device you use to show us that. Because we see this young Chinese woman skateboarding throughout a Chinese city. And I have to say, her impression about all of this was kind of disappointing to me. She thinks it's great. She thinks it's convenient. She thinks that it's going to make people behave better. But talk a little bit about this part. There's the part of maintaining social order.
Absolutely. Well, I think why Amy Webb's work was so important was that she really sets up that there's these two countries that are the big research institutions for AI because they have all this data, yeah. right? Google and Facebook. Not everybody has access to all your data. So these companies are really uniquely situated. And so she talks about the six companies in the US and three in China that are shaping AI. And what she talks about is that there are two parallel tracks for the development of these technologies, and one of them is authoritarian. Mm. And so what China is doing is that if you're a Chinese citizen and you want access to the internet, it has now been mandated that you have to submit to facial recognition. You are in a database. And the way it works now in China, where you can also, go to airports, pay for food, be let into your house with your face, is now then your face becomes part of this scoring system. Hmm. Where then you are tracked. And so if you buy, a pro-democracy book and you're my friend, maybe my score is going to come down. And this is going to have real consequences. The woman says people who lose credit may not be able to take trains or planes or any of that. And so it becomes this algorithmic training. And I think the frightening thing, and it's sort of like a Black Mirror episode, but only inside a documentary.
Totally.
But I think what is so amazing about this skater, because if I can tell the truth about that, when I was cutting the footage, we cut it visually,
yeah.
and the translator came in later. So we saw this skateboarder, we sort of cut the language, and then we're going through the interview, and we're like, oh my God, she supports the system.
Yeah, right? Because you think, I love that part about it. I'm like, oh, she's hip, she's a skateboarder, she's not into this, but she fully was. But that was interesting to me.
But the thing that she says that I hope everyone hears is that she says it's great, it's really convenient.
Yeah.
So,
and it's going to help her pick her friends. Like, she doesn't have to rely on her own instincts anymore to pick her friends because she'll just look at their social credit score.
Exactly. And then she has to know. And so, just to geek out for another minute on science fiction.
Go for it.
So Aldous Huxley, author of Brave New World, writes a letter to George Orwell, 1984. They swap books, right? And Aldous Huxley, and if you vacation with me, I will make you read this letter aloud. It's a very important letter.
Great.
But basically, Aldous Huxley thanks George Orwell for his book, and I'm paraphrasing very badly here, but says, in the future, you will not have to control people by force. That oppression, that it will happen through this seduction. And rulers will teach people to love their oppression. And they said it will be brought about by increasing reliance on efficiency. Mm. and convenience. And to me, when she says it's so convenient, I hope that it resonates with us in the West. What are we trading for our convenience? What are we giving up? And when we sort of outsource our decision-making to machines. And, okay, we don't have this credit score, but we're checking somebody out on Facebook, right? Looking how many friends they have and what their this score, and sort of creating this digital evaluation system that maybe, like, we might still meet them like this woman,
yeah,
but we've created an opinion about this yeah person through this level of scoring. And so what I think Amy does so well is situate the danger, I mean, of this precautionary tale. And I just want to say that we rely on China for our technical systems. So what happens, you know, this when, you know, this controversy over 5G, but mm-hmm we've seen China flex in their economic power in ways they haven't before. And if you look at this latest thing that happened with the NBA, right, where they are flexing, and American companies are having to choose, do they want the China market or do they want to be democratic?
Yeah.
And it's up to us to say, it's more important for you to be democratic. Are you democratic companies? Are you just capitalist first companies?
Yeah.
And that is the hard choice we have to make.
Well, I think the point is also made in the film that if you think sitting here in the United States smugly that this thing wouldn't happen, that in China there, you know, that it wouldn't happen here, the point is made, in China at least they're upfront about it. They're right out in the open about it. In the United States, it's a more subtle sort of thing, and it works through commercial companies as well.
Absolutely. I mean, Kathy and Zainab sort of set up this way in which we're tracked even online.
Yeah.
And Kathy talks about her best friend in the film, Kiri, is a principal for a science and math school for girls, and it's sort of for low-income girls. And she talks about, Kathy talks about how Kiri students who are low-income and of color and girls get targeted with University of Phoenix ads, right, which are predatory private college ads that don't lead for anything, right? But only they get targeted. Kathy's sons do not get targeted with the same kind of marketing. So what happens when children are consistently marketed with predatory ads and other people are predatory with SAT prep ads? How are we tracking people? What happens when your Google search says climate change is a, and the predictive says is a hoax for you and says is the largest
threat
facing humanity?
Yeah.
What happens when our information landscape is being tracked?
It's a completely unequal idea. It's like the scale of inequality could just exacerbate to a point. It's extraordinary.
It's extraordinary. And so I feel, I mean, we talk about disruptive tech, and I feel sort of like the women in my film are disrupting the disruptors.
Yeah.
Because they're also disrupting democracy, and they're also disrupting civil rights, and they're also disrupting freedom to assemble, and they're also disrupting freedom of expression. Now it's pretty easy for us to put, you know, something up on Facebook. It's pretty hard to censor us. But if the algorithm buries it to the last and no one ever sees your post, do we have freedom of press?
Yeah.
Do we have freedom of speech? And so these are all questions we need to be asking, and our legislators need to be way up on their game when it comes to technology.
Yeah. I want to, Silke Carlo, I referenced her mm-hmm before. She's in the film. She's the director of Big Brother Watch mm-hmm in the UK. And she reads from George Orwell's 1984, mm-hmm, this section where from habit that becomes an instinct, this assumption that everything, you know, every sound you make is overheard, every movement is scrutinized. She mentions it. And then there's this moment for the film where she talks about how she used to think that was just in a book.
You know, when we were younger, that was still a complete fiction. It could never have been true. And now it's completely true. I mean, people have Alexas in their home. Our phones can be listening devices. Everything we do on the internet, which is basically also now functions as a stream of consciousness for most of us, that is being recorded and logged and analysed. We are now living in the awareness of being watched, and that does change how we allow ourselves to think and develop as humans.
What do you think she means by that? I was really struck. This could change how we think and develop as humans.
I've seen it within my lifetime too. I mean, I had the gift of having a childhood in private, and I had the gift of not being in public for everything. And so we've become voyeurs of our own experience. We see it when I, you know, you go to any tourist place and no one is actually looking. They're just taking selfies. We've become voyeurs of our own experience. And it's become less important about our own experience, but we're constantly performing for a public. And I think that really changes human behavior in a massive way. And even for me, you know, I've lived in New York a long time. I remember when I just assume, I don't do anything on a street in New York that I wouldn't do on television.
Yeah. Because it's being recorded, more than likely.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think, and we don't know about facial recognition. 117 million Americans are in a facial recognition database, and we don't know how it's being used. On my flight here from New York, I saw Delta saying, "One look up and we got you," and it was supposed to be in a non-ironic way. Yeah. And I think sci-fi is such a great parallel.
Yeah.
Because it allows us to see when these things pop up. Like, this feels like it's out of Brazil or it's out of 1984. Is this not ironic to you? This is real? Yeah. this thing, what could go wrong, you know?
Let me play one more moment from the film. This is for the sociologist Zeynep Tufekci.
The thing I actually fear is not that we're going to go down this totalitarian 1984 model, but that we're going to go down this quiet model where we are surveilled and socially controlled and individually nudged and measured and classified in a way that we don't see to move us along paths desired by power. So it's not what will AI do to us on its own, it's what will the powerful do to us with the AI.
I wanted to ask you about, you were mentioning before, and this comes up in the film, this idea of trying to keep in the scheme of things kind of the human element rather than being tempted by, as you said, the convenient or the completely fully efficient. And this temptation to automate everything, that we somehow keep the human element in all of this. But that's going to be a real struggle, it seems.
We have to ask AI for what? Algorithms for what? Right? And it's up to us to keep our humanity. Is progress, are we defining progress by just the advancement of technology in a life that just is where all our decisions are made by us and we're tracked and surveilled and half asleep through our lives? Mm. And, you know, I was recently at a TED conference and someone said, I said, "What do you do?" And he says, "I make AI." And I said, "Great. For what?" And he says, "I make AI that makes you happier." And I said, "How do you do that?" He says, "I track what you do and I remind you to do those things." The AI tracks what you do and I remind you to do those things. I said, "Oh, interesting. My girlfriends do that for me."
They're humans.
We're humans. Yeah. And so we can't lose that.
Well, Joy talks about what it means to be human is to be vulnerable, because that gives you the capacity for empathy, and that we have to somehow, she says, if there's a way we can think about that in our technology, we could maybe reorient the questions we're asking, like being more vulnerable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have got to stop and look at what we're losing in this march towards endless efficiency and optimization and convenience, and start to look at, like, what are the societal implications of this? What is the human implications of this? I would love to see our country have an AI strategy that was actually for the public good. But I think deeper than that, I feel I have a lot of friends that sort of work in robots and AI. We've talked about singularity and all this crazy stuff, but yeah. I've sort of like our thought experience over drinks is always like, what do you do when the sum total of human intelligence, everything that we know, is in a AI? And we decided like what makes us human is to like screw up and make really big mistakes and to be flawed and to be human. And that's, and I think in the making of this film, what I realize is that our flaws and our biases and the places we can't see each other and our limited abilities, all of our human limitations, is everything that's great about being human. And that the more we can have compassion for the places that we are hurt and broken in unique ways, and the places that we have blind spots and can't see clearly, and the more that we can sort of shine a light for one another into those blind spots, that can only come from sitting together, talking with each other, and like having these human interactions about life experience, can we solve these larger issues? My thing would be humanity first.
That's Shalini Kantaya. She's director of the documentary film Coded Bias, which premiered this year at the Sundance Film Festival. You can see it for free next Wednesday night. We're going to be screening it as part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can connect with us on Twitter. We're at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Ivana Martinez is our intern. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.